What is up, everybody, and welcome back to the Small Lake City podcast. As you hopefully know by now, I am your host, Eric Nilsson, and we're a day late. It is Saturday, but it's because I haven't had internet for a week at my new house, and it has been problematic. So thankfully, that's hopefully going to be resolved by the time you're listening to this, so we can get back to our regularly scheduled programming. But for now, we have a pretty cool guest for this week. So if you've been following since the beginning, you know I've had a lot of artists in Salt Lake. I think it's fascinating to learn more about our art community, how much caliber of artists that we have here and the network that they have, and it continues to grow. But this week, we're going to take it in a little different angle. So one person I've met through John Darley and Howard Lyon, who I've had on the podcast, is a man by the name of Ben Hammond. Now, Ben Hammond is not a painter. He doesn't even like painting. He does it every now and then to remind himself that he doesn't like painting. But what he does like to do, loves to do, is sculpt. So he is a sculptor and phenomenal at it. He's been doing it since he dropped out of college professionally, been working on some amazing projects, some huge works of art that he's been able to work on around the community, and has right now been working on a multi-year project with a client that I can't name, but it's going to be amazing when it's done. He's also one of few sculptors that do the busts for the NFL Hall of Fame. So does a lot of really cool projects. And like one thing I'll add is when you go into a workshop or studio of a sculptor, it is a completely different story. So he has all of his works in his studio, all of the different renderings from, small first versions all the way through, 10, 15 foot sculptures. It was fun to see that firsthand, but even more fun to get to know Ben, hear his story of growing up in Blackfoot, Idaho, learning how to build and farm to becoming what he is now, a professional fine sculptor and also a yoga teacher. And if you were to see him walking down the street, you would never assume that that is what he did. No detriment to him, but he crushes it at both of these things, is a great father, a great person in his community, and just a great head on his shoulders. So excited to share this one with you guys. Hopefully you enjoy it as much as I do, but let's hear from Ben and his story of how he became a sculptor and what he is working on now. Check it out.
Oh, yeah, it's good to be back here. Because I remember when I came over here the first time with John, it was funny because he prefaced it with just keep in mind, sculptor studios are way cooler than painting studios. And I was like, okay, why? And then we get here and I'm like, oh, I get it. Everything is on display and everything is there compared to painting where it's you do work and it's gone.
Yeah. Yeah. Sculptor studios are the best.
Yeah.
No, it's the highest form of art anyways. Every painter really wants to be a sculptor deep down.
They just can't get that extra dimension in. It's kind of like the snowboarders want to be the skiers. They can't keep track of two things at once.
Yeah, I know what that's like because I'm a snowboarder and I tried skiing again this last year with all my friends. And I was just like, I hate this. I just couldn't do it. And I thought it was time to change because my knees can't handle snowboarding anymore. And so I thought, oh, I'll ski because then I got both legs that I'll always be using. Anyways, I'm just I couldn't do it. Yeah, I had a hard time.
I'm going back to my studio.
Yeah.
Do something else, even if it's just drums or guitar. But
yeah. But I do that even when I paint. I'll paint every once in a while kind of to remind myself that that I don't love painting.
Yeah.
And that was something that was interesting when I was in college. I remember taking painting classes. And being one of the guys that was one of the top painters in the class out of that group, particular class, and my painting teachers were like, man, you can paint. If you keep this up, you could really do it. And I'm just like, yeah, but I don't love it. As I'm painting, I'm like, I wish I had clay in my hands. And luckily I had a really good professor that was wondering the whole time, oh, should I have done something else? So
yeah, better to get it out now than wake up at your deathbed and be like, well, it would have been nice if I would have been I'm trying to think of something like a metal worker or something.
Yeah, I don't know. I've taught, it's interesting, I've taught a lot of workshops in the past, and I think that was the thing that I learned more than anything from teaching those workshops was how many older people, retired, always wanted to be a sculptor or an artist, but just either their dad wouldn't pay for art school, or everyone in their family told them not to, or they didn't have a supportive spouse or something like that. And it just made me so sad for them, because I was just like, I always had a really good support system from my parents, from my wife, from teachers that I had in school. And so it was just like, man, I'm grateful that everybody's like, yeah, go for it. Yeah, do it.
Yeah. I mean, it's such like a, it seems like such a small detail, but then to see how that's even that little bit of support in a direction that might not be the most, the avenue that the parents wouldn't vote for if they could choose.
Yeah.
But then it's fun to see the parents that support them. Like a good example of this is Howard. Like Howard, yeah. He goes to his family's like, listen, I love drawing. I like painting. Like, I want to try this out. And his dad's like, cool. Let's make this happen. If you love this, let's put some oxygen on this fire. And compared to the ones where it's like, oh, nope, let's go back to work on like algebra. Like, let's go do this. And then I think it's so, yeah.
Now my dad does tell me though, that like when I called him and said, hey, I'm dropping out of school and just going straight into sculpture, because this thing that I'm doing right now at BYU is not working out. And at the time he was just like, okay. But I ask him now and he's like, I have never prayed so hard for my child to like, you know, have success or, you know, that he'd figure out to go back to school. He's like, I wasn't going to tell you because I still wanted you to figure it out. But his words were, you know, I raised you to work hard. You can always work in the oil fields if you need to. You're the type of person that can, I taught you how to build houses and things like that. There's other things you can fall back on if things don't work out. So. But he said he was quite worried, but he wasn't going to say anything. He wasn't going to squash my dreams or anything. So
that's a good thing.
But he was also, at the time, he was a superintendent, so he was an educator. My mom, on the other hand, was, you know, she's a professional musician. She was teaching piano at Rick's College at BYU Idaho at the time. And she was all for dropping out. She's just like, you know.
Just cheering behind your dad.
She's just like, oh, just go for it. She's like, those professors at school think they know everything. They don't know anything. They don't know what it's like to be creative, to actually go out and do it. So she's like, if they're telling you you can't do it, then go prove them wrong.
So here you are, proving them wrong.
I guess. I don't know if any of them feel bad for saying that I was crazy to do what I was doing. Because, I mean, I did have teachers at that time that did think I was nuts to like drop out of school and work at a foundry and try to figure out how to cast things in bronze and stuff like that. So, but I mean, I don't think I tried to prove them wrong necessarily. I just really wanted to do it. It was so exciting. I worked at a foundry and I was seeing all these monuments being cast in bronze and working on them. My particular thing that I did at the foundry was patinas. So I was doing the coloration at the end and I got to spend time with the artists. So I got to meet artists from literally all over the world. And man, it was awesome. I just, even though I was making like less than 10 bucks an hour and, you know, we were expecting a kid and it was just like, it was all awesome. It was just exciting.
It's such a great foundation to where it was now. But I want to go back to the beginning because, like, obviously you're not from Utah. You're from Idaho. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, how did you even find this? Because, like to your point, anybody who looks at you and you're like, I am a sculptor who is a yoga teacher, I don't think they would believe you. And that's no detriment to you. I mean, honestly, it's like a compliment, if anything. But, I mean, how did this all get started?
Well, it started with modeling clay. My mom just getting me some modeling clay when I was a kid. And I always liked to draw. I always had pen and paper and pencil and paper. My hand was always drawing. And I remember my mom got me like one of those like hobby store, those bricks of clay that come with the primary colors. I took them and mushed them all together and it turned into this like gray, brown, muckety muck mess because there wasn't enough clay. I tried to sculpt something in color, but I'm like, with the different colors, but I'm like, I need more clay. So I'm like, what am I going to do? I'm going to mash everything together. Kind of like when I had Legos and I wanted to build something different than the set, I had to just combine all the sets. So I kind of did that with the clay. And that's when I realized that I wasn't as interested in color as I was as form. Like, so having a gray brown color of clay that I was mushing around didn't bother me. Like a lot of people couldn't stand to mix those different types of modeling clay, but I did. And so that's when I realized as a young kid that I liked form. I liked like three-dimensional form. And then by the time I was in high school, I had this awesome high school art teacher, Mrs. Marriott, Colleen Marriott. And she wasn't herself a great artist, but she loved inspiring and pushing people to do great. So she brought in like professional artists all the time, as much as she could find in, you know, middle of nowhere, Southeast Idaho, where I grew up and going to Snake River High School, which is outside of Blackfoot. And when I was a senior, each senior year, she did a special senior trip where they like went to San Francisco or to Salt Lake or somewhere. I mean, once they even went to like Wyoming so they could go see some original Minerva Tykert paintings. But my senior year, she took our class down here to Utah, and we went to Gary Ernest Smith, who's a painter, to his studio, and we went to Blair Buswell's, who was a sculptor. And I walk in to Blair Buswell's studio. It's just like this garage next to his house. And, you know, I was there. My wife was there. She wasn't my wife at the time, obviously, but I was mostly worried or focused on holding her hand or smooching her or something like that. Get something like, you know, that as a 17-year-old version of me, that's what I was most interested in. But I remember walking into his studio and just being blown away. He had a sculpture of Oscar Robertson, life and a quarter size, that he was doing for the University of Cincinnati. And I walked in and it was like walking in and seeing Michelangelo's David. I had no idea that there were human beings alive right now on earth that were creating like beautiful classical figurative sculpture. And so he hadn't put the jersey and the shorts on yet. So he was just doing the nude figure of Oscar Robertson at that scale. And I remember just walking in there, just being blown away. And then I saw that he had these busts on the shelf up on the side, just like behind here.
Yeah.
And I'm like, are those for the Pro Football Hall of Fame? And he's like, yeah, I do. I'm a sculptor for the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And I'm just like, oh my gosh, because I love football, I love sports. Just
everything is coming together in your life at this moment.
And I love sculpture, and I'm just like, what? And I couldn't even ask a question. I just remember being in there and just being dumbfounded. And then Blair took our group over to the foundry at Wasatch Bronze, which was in Orem at the time. And we went into this foundry, and we got to see the process of casting sculptures in bronze, like the whole process, making the mold, pouring the wax, putting the wax in an investment, melting out the wax, pouring in bronze. And we got to see him actually pour molten bronze into these ceramic investments, and the bronze would cool and they'd break it apart. And I'm just like, this is like the coolest thing I've ever seen. It was like everything that I loved, because I grew up working on a farm, welding, building homes with my dad and my grandpa, building industrial buildings. I'd worked in Eastern Washington between my junior and senior year, building these big potato cellars and onion cellars. I loved all of the physical labor that was going into creating these sculptures. And I just was hooked. I'm just like, from that point on, I had in my mind that I wanted to be a sculptor. Now, by the time I'd...
And in that high school class, were you sculpting at all, or was it mostly like painting and...
Well, you're sculpting, but like there wasn't any instruction. Nobody knew how to sculpt.
I was just curious if there like was this gap between the two.
I took like ceramic classes, and I was actually pretty good at ceramics. Mrs. Bohannon was the ceramics teacher, and she's like, I have never seen a student make nested bowls like that actually fit inside each other. So I had it like the project was due with three bowls that nested inside each other. And so I'm using the wheel, and I figured out how to use the wheel. And she's just like, oh my gosh, you have a gift. And I'm like, I can't stand doing this. The wheel like irritated me.
Yeah.
Cause I wanted to stop and take that clay and start molding it and modeling it into something. And luckily when I got to college at Ricks College, it was the first time that I actually had a sculpture class from a sculptor. Matt Geddes taught the class, and man, as soon as we were sculpting, I told my wife, I'm like, I gotta do this. I gotta be a sculptor. And she's kind of like, okay, I don't know about this. Cause at the time, graphic design had a 100% job placement.
Yeah.
And so I'm just like, it's the late 90s, and I'm just like, oh, maybe I'll go into graphic design. That seems stable. You know, I'm married. I got to, you know, support a family. And anyways, Carrie, my wife, comes into the sculpture studio, and she sees some of the stuff that I'm working on, and she's like, go for it. She's like, you've got a gift. Like, she's like, you're good. And so from that point on, it was like full steam ahead. And like I said, I mentioned before, I had, you know, painting teachers and things like that. They were just like, hey, yeah, you can sculpt. Let's do it. What can we do to help you? And so I went from that environment at Ricks College, then I went down to BYU, which was much more of a philosophical approach to art, which I don't criticize. It just wasn't for me. I was ready. I just needed practical instruction. I needed competent teachers to teach me and show me how to like model a human figure, like study anatomy and things like that. And that I could see early on wasn't going to be happening. So after 3 weeks, I discontinued. I dropped out.
Nice.
You know, I was leaving behind a full scholarship. I had an academic and art scholarship, and you know, I just didn't do it. My wife, on the other, she was an art major too. She stuck with it. She graduated from BYU, and she was kind of like, I don't know how to paint. She's like, I have this degree, but I don't know how to paint. So she started doing what I did. She started taking workshops and learning from other painters. And, you know, she's a great painter. So, but that's how she learned. She kind of, you know, that philosophical approach, like I said, it's not bad for people that are kind of trying to figure out who they are, what they want to do. But I already, from the moment I was 17 and I saw Blair's studio, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to do monumental figurative artwork.
Yeah.
And so when I was down here going to school, I was just like, okay, if I really want to do this, I got to find the master. So I found the foundry where Blair Buswell was casting his work. I got a job there. And every time he would come in, I'd say, Blair, I'm Ben Hammond. I met you when I was in high school. I want to be a sculptor. You're like, I can still remember Oscar Robertson. You know, he was flattered, but for the most part, he's like, who's this weirdo?
Yeah, like,
but after a while, I kept on bringing stuff in. I always had stuff there at the foundry. And every time he was in, I'm like, hey, do you have a second? Can you come look at my work? Give me a critique. And, you know, he'd tear me apart and just be like, what are you doing? This is wrong. This is wrong. And, which was, he was really generous about that. And for me, that never bothered me to get like torn down.
Yeah. Cause when you're that hungry for it, you want that feedback.
Yeah.
Coming from someone who you already respect so much.
Absolutely.
I mean, you're just this hungry dog ready to get like.
And you know, I asked every artist that came through there, even looking back, I'm like, oh my heck, I can't believe I asked that guy or that lady for advice. Cause I nothing personal. But I mean, like they weren't at the level of some of the other artists, but that doesn't matter. What matters was I learned that people are really generous with their knowledge, and I was never afraid to ask people like, well, how did you do that? How do I get into galleries? What do you do? And with Blair though, I wanted to work for him. I didn't just want his advice. I'm like, every time I saw him, I'm like, hey, do you need someone to sweep your floors? Like, mush clay for you and hand it to you, whatever. And one day he finally came up to me and he's just like, hey, I just took on this big project and I need an assistant. Would you want to come work for me? And I'm like, heck yeah.
Like dream come true.
You know, and
I'll quit my job right now.
And the thing is that I want to articulate here is that he didn't hire me because of my sculpture prowess. He hired me because I grew up building homes, so I knew how to do woodworking. I knew my way around power tools and how to build stuff. I knew how to make molds. I learned how to make molds at the foundry. And he'd seen that I can do other things besides sculpt. The sculpting, you know, even when I ask him today, Blair, he's like, the sculpting was a bonus, but it wasn't really why I hired Ben. And I'm the same way. Like, I need help to build, like right now I'm like, man, I'd love an assistant that could actually build cabinets so I don't have to do it. Because so, then I could go upstairs and work and then they could just build the cabinets for me. But I loved that. I got hired by Blair at the same time he was taking on this huge project that he'd never done anything like it either. So he was hired to sculpt an entire wagon train a city block long in downtown Omaha, Nebraska. So he'd be sculpting oxen, mules, people, dogs, wagons, wagon wheels.
That's huge.
And so it was so fun for me because we were doing stuff that he's never sculpted animals before. So as he's learning ox anatomy and mule anatomy, I'm getting all that education where I'm learning about all this stuff too, and watching his thought process, how he's doing this comparative anatomy, because he was already a master of the human figure, but now he's trying to master something else. So I got to observe him with his meticulous, strong artistic drive for excellence, try to figure that stuff out. And it was so cool. So in the meantime, I'm sculpting a wagon, sculpting a roll of rope or a shovel or a pitchfork or, you know, stuff that he doesn't want to do.
Yeah,
so
yeah, you can go.
So I'm sculpting all this stuff, but he's in the same room. And eventually I earned this trust relationship with him where not only could I sculpt a knot and rope or wagon wood texture or something like that, but he's like, help me figure out this ox's foot. Like, what is going on here? And so he was really generous with his time and open-minded, not only to make time to critique my work, but let me critique his work too. And that was something that I learned early on, that like the great artists look at everyone as a critic. Like, what do you think? What can make it better? What do you not like? What do you like? It doesn't mean you have to take to heart everything everybody says, but it's always good to bounce ideas around, and that usually results in the best final product. I don't believe in an artist, you know, balling himself up in his own little room and you know, not sharing with the world, and just one day he's going to open his doors and have some masterpiece. I think the best artwork, everything I've studied through the years, artists had sort of a group of peers that they trusted that helped inspire them and help them with their artwork, at least critique wise. I mean, there's always the exception. Michelangelo was definitely a renowned loner and very private about his technique and how he did things. But for the most part, most sculptors and artists, painters had a strong group of peers that they relied on for critique.
And you always think about those groups throughout time, that it was like almost like these like 3 to 5, let's say, artists or painters that really relied on each other and did have that feedback, because again, like, you can only see to your ability, but if you have someone else you respect and they can see other things, then you grow together.
I remember, so this was Blair and I in 2005, we went to Boston. It was after we finished the first phase of this big wagon train, and he's like, let's take a break. So let's go out to like Augusta St. Gaudens old studio and Daniel Chester French's old studio and go to the Boston Museum of Art. And we went to the Isabel Stewart Gardner Museum. And that museum, Isabel Stewart Gardner Museum, like, it hit me in the face. All of a sudden I'm seeing I saw an etching that Anders Zorn did of Augusta St. Gaudens. And then I saw that Augusta St. Gaudens did this bas relief of John Singer Sargent's sister playing the guitar. And then I realized, I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. So Isabel Stewart Gardner, she's this wealthy aristocratic lady that loved art. She's very eccentric, and her architect, like, her house is a museum now. It's like crazy. It has like a medieval room, and then it has like something from the Far East that she's like taken apart somewhere and then reassembled here in this house. But she's also created this space where she'd have St. Gaudens, Anders Zorn, John Singer Sargent all like hanging out together in her house. Like, and I'm like, oh my gosh. Like, so you got all these masters of, you know, different mediums, but all just amazing in their same sphere, in their individual sphere, and like hanging out together and critiquing each other's work and doing paintings and sculptures of each other. And I'm just like, it blew me away. And I'm like, so that's why, you know, we have like our group of friends we try to hang out with and critique each other's work. Micah may or may not have called us the Art Vengers. I don't know.
The Art Vengers. He didn't mention that one, but that's stuck now.
Oh, maybe that's just the text thread title. But it's great to have. That's why Utah is so amazing. Like we go to shows all over the world, literally all over the world, and people are like, "Oh, where are you from?" And I'm like, "Oh, I live in Utah," and they're like, "What is going on in Utah, man? It is like all the best artists are in Utah." Even in the early 2000s, when I was first getting into galleries, like in Santa Fe and Scottsdale, I'd go in there and they'd look through my portfolio and they're like, "Wow, this is great. Where are you from?" And I'm like, "Oh, I live in American Fork, Utah." And they're like, "What is in the water up there? Like, what is going one? On? I remember one guy who was a gallery I was in for a while. He was an English fellow. And he's like, "Tell me, why are there so many great artists in Utah? Is it the church? Does the church command you to become an artist?" And I'm like, "No, what?" So that was probably one of the strangest things I've ever heard. But it always boiled down to the same thing. People outside of Utah recognize that Utah was this like artistic hub, and not only for visual arts, but I through the years I've noticed with music and movies and, you know, television programs, there's so much filming that goes on here.
There's something in the water that happens more than you'd think.
Well, and not only in the creative arts, but every creative field, like entrepreneurs, like people inventing things. Shark Tank, I think like 30% of the people on Shark Tank are from Utah County. Something like ridiculous like that. And it's just like, it's awesome. Because I grew up in, you know, where I grew up in Idaho, you made things work. I remember just being on the farm, it's potato harvest, and you've got a welder and some pry bars and stuff like that. When stuff broke down, you had to figure out how to make it work. You couldn't just like order on Amazon a new sprocket or, you know, a new link to your potato harvester. You had to like figure out how to weld it and jimmy rig it and make things work. And to me, I think I loved the creativity of just the simple farmer out, you know, harvesting potatoes or, you know, sugar beets or grain and just having to, you know, be creative on the fly to get the job done. And even growing up on the construction site with my dad and grandpa, I mean, my grandpa, he could take a coping saw and miter two crazy pieces of, you know, molding together that I'm just like, "Oh, I can't do it on this chop saw. What are you going to do?" And he'd like saw with this little tiny blade and make these two pieces fit so tightly that you wouldn't even need to caulk it or put any painter's putty on to finish it. And I was just like, I just remember as a kid just being blown away by high craftsmanship and people that just solved problems. Like they see a problem, they're like, "Well, let's make something work. Let's try to figure it out." And as an artist, that's all you're doing is you're solving a problem. Why doesn't this leg look right? Why doesn't this drapery or fold look right? Why doesn't this angle of the sculpture look as good as this angle? What can I do to change it? And you're just constantly solving problems. And you're mostly solving problems by making mistakes, doing something. It's like, "Oh, that doesn't look right." And you just keep trying it until it's like.
And you have to keep doing something, because if you just sit and stare at it, it's not going to take care of it.
Yeah, if you keep staring, if I sit down and stare at my sculpture, it's lights out. I'm asleep.
And he's out.
So I have to keep moving, you know, especially with all the projects I'm doing right now. Just like, there's so many long hours in the studio, but I still love it. I still feel strongly motivated to make whatever I'm doing really great. I don't know why. I don't think it makes me a better person than anybody else, but I feel very self-motivated to create great artwork, or at least something that hopefully somebody considers great.
Yeah. And I think that's the beauty of art. It's like, it's a journey, not a destination. It's not like you just go to law school, you become a lawyer. It's not, you go to medical school, you become a doctor. And not to say that's like, that's the end of that career there, but it's this dedication to the journey because there is no destination, but mm-hmm. you see so many people that are on the same road, the same journey to be there. And you start to realize like, hey, we can actually work together. Like even with, forgot his name, but the mentor that you had.
Yeah. Blair.
I mean, Blair, you're like, again, like be like, Blair, hey, Blair, you're here again. Let me show you this. Can I see that? Until the point he's like, all right, fine, come along. And then all of a sudden, like you almost catch up to his pace where you guys are relying on each other, riffing off of each other. And with this, I mean, huge project where he has to, like, it's not like he can be like, well, it helps if he can help, but if he can't help, then we'll just have him making clay and just doing yeah. more like administrative stuff or like behind the scenes stuff. And so I think that's one thing that's been really cool about, like Utah and the art community here, but it bleeds it, like to your point, it bleeds in everything else. Even, I mean, the conversations I've had with a lot of entrepreneurs and investors, it's very communal, and it goes mm-hmm. back to the original feeling of like Deseret itself, of this just community that grows together, thrives together, and I mean lives for each other too. So I'm curious. So you have this experience with Blair. I mean, at what point did you leave the house, so to speak, and go fly solo? Or maybe he was always part of the journey as you went on your own.
He's still part of the journey because you know we worked. Not only did we work together and he was my boss for many years. I mean, I worked for him full time for about, from about 2001 to 2009, and then about half part time all the way to 2011. And from that point on, I've accrued more and more work that has just kept me too busy. And then he'd have me come and work for him for a couple weeks, like every quarter. And now it's to the point where, you know, the last 7 or 8 years, I haven't been able to really help him at all, but he'll still like have me come over and give advice. Or if he has assistance, like, hey, Ben's going to talk you through how to do this point up or whatever. And then the same thing, he comes over here. Like when I was expanding my studio here, like, hey, what do you think? How should I do this? This is what I'm thinking. He's like, well, what if you did this? And it's like, oh, that'd be great. Like, I'm so glad he came over when we were framing, because I had half as many skylights. And he's like, that is not enough light. You got to double that. And I'm like, really? You think? And he's like, yes. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I almost made the dumbest mistake.
That's a hard one to go back and change.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. The roof and everything like that. But luckily I caught the guys the next day. I'm like, I'm sorry. You're going to have to frame in twice as many skylights. And they're like, okay, yeah, that's good thing you told us now. If we waited any longer, it would have been a pain, but that's fine. So they did. So about 2009 is when I stopped working full time. So I was working about 40 to 50 hours a week for Blair. And then I'd go home in my basement studio. I keep a picture of over my, the door right there. That's old studio downstairs in the basement of our old house.
Humble beginnings.
Yeah. I love being down there. So I'd get home from work from Blair's like 6 or so. I'd spend some time with my family, get everybody, put kids to bed. By 9:30, 10 o'clock, I was back in the studio till about 2 or 3 in the morning. So that was where I had, you know, another 5 or 6 hours that I could work on my own stuff downstairs. So the whole time I'm working for Blair, and Blair pushed me to do this. He's like, you've got to sculpt, you've got to work, you've got to go try to find your own niche and try to get into galleries. So that whole time I'm working for Blair, I'm sculpting, I'm winning awards, trying to get a name for myself. And you know, the whole time when I show my resume, it's like assistant of Blair Buswell. It was funny when I finally changed my resume where I didn't have to ride his coattails, which isn't offensive or anything like that. It's just like at the time, that's all I could really say. I didn't have any monumental work of my own that had my signature on it. All I could say was I helped Blair Buswell. And I remember finally I started getting some monuments under my belt, and I remember my wife and I were working on updating my resume, and she's like, I think it's time to say, yeah, you worked for Blair Buswell, put it in the resume back here, but you know, we need to make that not as important. Let's make it about you.
Got to put you on that center stage.
And so, yeah, from about 2010 till now, it's been, you know, pretty much full time doing my own stuff. And it's been awesome. Blair always jokes because he's like, yeah, I trained him so well. Now he's my, you know, stiffest competition, which is true. We've competed for the same monuments and stuff. And
sure, he wins some, you win some.
Yeah. And at one of the times he was on the committee that helped select the artists, and you know, he's really good. He's a good person. So he's not biased or anything or has any ulterior motive, but you know, eventually he's just like, yeah, you were the best one. So I encouraged him, like, just artistic merit, Let's just go off artistic merit. So, yeah. And now, you know, I can't talk about it yet, but eventually we're working on a project. We're working on the same project together. He's doing a part of it and I'm doing a part of it.
Oh, I didn't realize he was one of the people doing part of it with you.
Yeah. So that's awesome.
So when you started actually getting in the studio in your basement on your own, I mean, what kind of stuff did you gravitate to? Were you naturally going towards the same stuff you're working with Blair or did you have your own flair?
Well, it was human figure. Okay. And that's what Blair loves too. So when we were sculpting oxen and horses and mules and stuff, I mean, we did it, but it wasn't like it's not the same passion. You have the passion to do a good job. You have the passion to make it accurate and make it artistic. But I don't love horses. Blair grew up with horses and doesn't love horses. His dad had Arabian horses. He's like, he had terrible hay fever, so he didn't really like horses.
That'd be
I didn't like horses either. I liked motorcycles. I'd ride a horse. I hated riding things that had their own brain. So I'd rather have complete control and ride a motorcycle. So when I grew up, I'd ride dirt bikes all the time. I loved riding dirt bikes. So I'm very confident I can sculpt a horse and a mule and an ox and a dog accurately or any animal, but I just don't feel the same kind of passion or excitement that I do when I'm sculpting the human figure. And in particular, the female figure. The female figure is something that I wasn't very good at first. And Blair told me as much. He's like, you really need to work on the female figure. So I started working with a lot more female models, trying to figure out the female anatomy and this and the differences between male and female anatomy. And I got to the point where I really loved the shape of the female figure. Where Michelangelo loves the male figure, I love the female figure, and everybody's different. Daniel Chester French, I think, is one of the best sculptors of the female figure I've ever seen. So he's probably my favorite sculptor who I you know, if I need to go to the well, he's the first, you know, drink I take is Daniel Chester French. But it was all starting with model studies, because that was the advice Blair gave me. He said, work from life. So I was organizing, and other artists that were young artists like me, we were trying to do all these community model sessions. And out of necessity, just because we were all so poor, it's like we got to have a group of, you know, 5 to 10 artists so we can afford to hire a model, to have a model come and pose for 3 hours. So that's what we did. And just model study, like probably I had 3 model studies every week. And I think it was by about 2009 that I had read the 10,000 hours, the Malcolm Gladwell. And I'm like, I've literally put in 10,000 hours of sculpting from life. And the funny thing is that I tell people is like, I was not an expert by any stretch. It was like after 10,000 hours, it was like, now I finally have enough knowledge in my pocket that I know what I'm doing. And that's about it. Like, I know what I'm doing with the human figure, the human anatomy. I understand it, but it's not by no means am I some anatomy expert or figure expert, but I finally felt confident where I'd compare it to, I remember, Gary Ernest Smith, the painter, told me, one fine day, you're going to worry so much about your mixing your colors when you're painting. Should I go warmer? Should I go cooler? How do I go cooler? How do I go warmer? And you're thinking about all the color wheel and everything. And he said, one fine day, you just look down at your palette and you're like, warmer, darker, and you don't even think about it. You're just, you know, and you don't. So that's where I got after about 10,000 hours, where it was like, oh, I feel confident, where I don't have to think so much about this is that bone, this is that muscle, this is that. You know,
just like second nature.
Yeah. It was just second nature, where it's like, okay, I got a figure in front of me. It's all abstract now. It's not bones, muscles, and sinews. It's shapes, forms. And now I can start creating artwork. Now I can start designing. And it's funny, cause you can even see it in my artwork, where early on from about 2004 till about 2010, everything that I did was a single figure that was well rendered with some drapery on it. And that's about it. And some other elements, whether it was a nude figure or a draped figure. Then after about 2010, all of a sudden you start seeing more like rocks or dramatic, like wings start appearing on some of my pieces. And it's like, cause I was done just sculpting the human figure. The human figure was a vehicle to create artwork, and whether it became an angel or multi-figured pieces. And that's what I really started gravitating towards, was multi-figure pieces. And that's kind of now what I'm kind of known for, is my real dynamic interloping, interlocking, like multi-figure pieces.
Yeah. I mean, it's fun to like probably look back as an artist, because even things I've done, I look back and like, yeah, we've come a long way. But it's fun, I bet, to be like, oh, here is one of the figures that I first did with Blair, compared to looking at this, you're like, this is night and day difference, and seeing how you go, like, in such a tangible way too. Because I mean, everybody can see eventually that they've grown over time, but there usually isn't this well documented, very tangible, very like obvious ways to see it different. And especially as you continue to work and get refined, your eye gets more attuned to it, and you only know what you can learn and understand. So I think that's such a fun process to go to.
It really is. And I love looking in here and like seeing, like, I remember when I did this piece here, the stone cutter, that was like 2004, I think. So I had this like a rugby player from Samoa that modeled for us. And I was really into Mahan Rai Young. I think they had a big show at BYU of like an introspective of all of his work. So I did this big, strong laborer. And I'm like, yeah, it's a figure and it has some artistic value, but mostly it's about the figure, about the single figure, the tension holding that rock. And then all of a sudden you go across the room and you have that sculpture over there with the eight figures, the seven women and the little boy all intertwined that I did for the women's walk. And I'm like, okay, yeah, that journey from 2004 to 2017 is a huge jump in, I would say, confidence. Confidence would be like confidence that I can pull off a multi-figure, all this drapery, all this hair, all this stuff coming together and making a concise, like, simple form, even though there's tons of figures and stuff to it.
Yeah. And so I'm curious, so I didn't know about the story about when you went to on the trip and you saw that he was working on the Hall of Fame bus, but how did you get to in turn also be one of the people that can make the Hall of Fame bus?
Okay. So in 2005, Blair finally, and I'd been working for him for about 3 or 4 years at that time in 2005, and I'd helped him block in a few busts, and he's the head sculptor of the Hall of Fame. He's the guy. He's the one that's got a contract to the Hall of Fame. If anyone else does a bust, it's his doing. He picks the other artists. So in 2005, I blocked in a couple busts for him. 2006, I blocked in a bust even closer where he's like, take it as far as you can.
Oh, wow.
And I'm like, okay. So that one was Benny Friedman. So it was an old timer. It was a posthumous bust. So I just had a few pictures, and Blair's like, just take it as far as you can. So I did. And then he finished it. And the next year he said, okay, this one's going to be yours. This one you can sign, even though he still helped me a ton on it. But he's like, I mean, I can still remember at the end, he's like, I guess you can put, I mean, you didn't do this. You know, I did it. Like I led you here. And I'm like, and I remember being kind of like, kind of annoyed at the time. Now I totally get it, but I'm just like, oh. And it was just interesting, the way I'd describe it, from about 2007 till now has just gradually been less and less hand-holding from Blair, where now, like in the last 10 years, I mean, it took 4 or 5 years before he's like, okay, you finally get it. You can do portraits now. Now you're a portrait artist. And so, and I've kept learning. And every time I think I'm pretty darn good, like every year I'm like, oh my gosh, this year's Hall of Fame bus, I did awesome. The 3 guys I did this year, or 4 guys I did this year. And then I go and see what Blair's working on. And I'm like, gosh, dang it.
Right when I think I had it.
Yeah. Well, and to me, it's just always, you can't beat 20 extra years of experience. So Blair's 20 years ahead of me in his career. So no matter what I do, I can't make up for those 20 years, because he's been at it and he keeps trying to improve too. So, and it's okay. There's certain things that I do better than him, like bas relief. Like whenever he's working on a relief, he's like, get over here, relief master. You're the guy that knows, understands this. And, I help him out. He helps me out. Especially when you're doing a portrait, it's always good to have an extra set of eyes. And the best part about Hall of Fame is both of us usually get to meet the guys. And so we know what they look like, and we observe certain things and help each other out. And So, yeah, the Hall of Fame thing. So from about 2007 to about 2010 was a lot of help from Blair, and then it lessened and lessened, and now it's, you know, it's just pretty much, it's kind of my gig. It's That's my cool. gig to inherit from him when he retires from it someday, if he ever does. Yeah. His retirement from the Hall of Fame will probably be at his funeral, where I'm like, well, I guess he's finally done.
Weird. He dropped this note saying it's my job now. Huh. He signed it too. Doesn't look like my handwriting at all.
So, yeah. Well, it's literally, that's the understanding contractually and everything. But anyways, it's just like.
He just loves it so much.
He loves it so much, and he's just so good. I mean, it's not like he's slowing down or getting less capable.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, it's like when I was talking to Howard, I was like, oh, like what's, like. He'll have friends come up to him and be like, well, what's after painting? He's like, if I were to retire, I would travel and I would paint. In life right now, I get to travel and I get to paint.
Yeah, I don't.
And so it's a similar way. It's like, oh, I love to sculpt.
It's funny talking to our accountant. He's like, so what are your retirement plans? And I'm like, keep sculpting.
Bigger studio.
Maybe, yeah.
I mean, there have to be if you keep.
So, that's the funny thing is, I remember when I moved into this studio before I did the addition, I'm like, oh, this is great. And then like after 5 years, it was like, I'm running out of room. Cause it was just interesting. All of a sudden, you know, up to that point to about 2017, with the exception of the women's walk with the 8 figures in one monument, I was doing pretty simple monuments for the most part. The last simple monument I did was Martha Hughes Cannon that will go to the U.S. Capitol. And that was finished in 2020. And then right after that, I got a commission from Idaho Central Credit Union. The CEO calls me up. He's like, I want you to do a sculpture for me. I'm like, okay, yeah, sure. I hear that all the time.
Yeah.
And then they hear how long it's going to take and how much it's going to cost. And they're like, nah, we need it quick. We'll find somebody else. I'm like, okay. You can always find someone who'll do it cheaper, faster. But, you know, you won't find someone that can do it better. So he said, no, I want you to do it. And I want it to be great. And he just basically said, here's the space. Start throwing out some ideas, what you think would work. So I started doing some sketches. And he was just like, oh, yeah, these are awesome. And this isn't about 2017, 2018, I think. And he's just like, how big should we make this? I'm like, it needs to be big in this space. And he's like, yeah, I think so. So I did, like, I took a picture of this little like 12-inch tall sketch and I blew it up. I blew up one that was 12 feet tall and one that was 16 feet tall. And we printed it on paper on a foam core. And I just held them out up in the space. And I said, what do you think? Here's the 12-foot version of it. And here's the 16-foot version of it. And he's like, it's got to be the 16, right? And I'm like, I think so.
Like, yeah, that sounds
good. And I'm like, but it's going to be this much. And he's like, well, we can do that. And I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
And I'm like, let's do it. So all of a sudden I'm doing this 16-foot tall. This one had 9 different figures on it. This big, huge monument. And I'm trying to do it in the studio by taking it apart and I'm working on pieces. And then I have to go to Blair's studio because he has an overhead crane to finally put it all the way back together. And then his studio isn't even tall enough to put the final 3 figures up on top. So I never even saw it finished all the way at full scale until it was cast in bronze. It was at the foundry. And it was like 16 feet tall to the top, barely fit out of the door. Like we couldn't even like put it on a forklift. We had to barely put it. We had to make a special pallet that a floor jack could just barely lift it up to slide it out the door. And it literally cleared by like a quarter of an inch of the garage door. So it couldn't have possibly been any taller. And it was just like, it was awesome. I'm like sitting there in this was probably 2021 when it was unveiled. Or was it? No, it was 2022. I can't even remember. But it was like, it was awesome. I remember going up there and I got this 16-foot tall sculpture up in Pocatello, Idaho. And I'm an awesome CEO of a company that's just like, do your thing, man.
Yeah.
Like, what an empowering, amazing, like, person to let me do that. And it's, to this day, I look at it and I'm like, this is what I've been working towards. This is what I always wanted to do. It was cool because my mom was there and she's like, you've been drawing stuff like this with multi-figures since you were a little kid. And she's like, here it is in bronze.
Yeah.
And
Gotta be a cool mom moment.
Oh man, it was awesome. I mean, I'm getting a little emotional about it right now. I'll try not to get teary eyed, but it was like, it was so cool to have like my awesome supportive mom that she's just like, I mean, she couldn't have known what it would turn into, but she was always encouraging like that sort of thing. And it's cool to see all seven of us siblings all, you know, successful at whatever we're doing. Yeah. I mean, I've got a philosophy professor brother. I've got a doctor sister, you know, a guy, one of my brothers builds nuclear reactors all over the world. Oh, sorry. Kick the microphone.
It's very durable.
He's really funny. He's like, yeah, I'm like, what are you working on now? He's like, oh, your tax dollars at work, you know, building another nuclear power plant for some other country. Oh, it's awesome. We won't get into politics on this thing, right? So it's just awesome to, see what hard work, dedication, single-mindedness can produce in any field. And, you know, it just goes back to hard work. Everyone always asks, like, how did you become such a successful artist? And I'm like, I grew up on a farm.
Learned how to work hard.
Yeah.
And I worked hard.
Works never bother me. I never liked video games. I can sit down and watch a movie every once in a while, but I definitely can't watch TV like every day.
Just like mindless, turn something on.
Oh, yeah. I can't do it. I'm trying to think, what do I like to do? I like to mow the lawn. That's about it.
There you go. Mow the lawn and sculpt. Well, actually, there is something else you like to do. So talk to me about how yoga came into the picture.
Oh, yoga came in the picture because of sculpture. So I was lifting this super heavy – this is – okay. So it's a combination of Idaho farm boy / sculpture. So this is all comes full circle. So the Idaho farm boy can do anything physical. Like, we'll figure out a way to do something. So Blair had this second story storage space, and I didn't want to bother him. I didn't have anybody else working at the time. And I have this mold that's probably about 140 pounds. And I'm like, I got to get this up there. And I'm like, I'm just going to get this ladder and just walk it up the ladder.
Yeah, I can do this.
So I do. I pick up this big mold. I'm like, okay. It was the horse's neck from the wagon master of this. The wagon train. Anyways, I'm picking it up and I'm going up about 4 or 5 steps, and all of a sudden it starts falling on one side. And of course, Idaho farm boy, you're not going to let that drop. You're going to get your butt kicked by your dad if you mess up or something like that. Or the farmer's going to get mad if you break the sprinkler pipe or whatever. So I'm just like, with all my might, I'm like, no, I'm going to pick it up, and I get it up, and I'm just like, and all of a sudden I felt something in my back, just like, oh man, that hurts. So what do? I walk it the rest of the way up, put it on the shelf. I get back down, and I'm like, oh, man, my back feels weird. Uh-oh. And just keep working. Finally, after about 3 months of my back just feeling weird, I go in and get an MRI, and my doctor calls me up, and he's like, what the hell did you do? I'm like, what?
Not a good thing to hear from your doctor.
He's like, it looks like World War III in your lumbar spine. And I'm like, oh, okay. What does that mean? And he's like, you've destroyed 3 of your discs. And I'm just like, oh. He's like, when did you do this? I'm like, 3 months ago. And he's like, do you need painkillers or anything? I'm like, no, I'm fine. Just feels uncomfortable. Anyways, so I get sent, they wanted to fuse my spine. I went to this chiropractor because I'm like, I don't want it rot in my back. And anyways, and the whole time I'm still working, I'm still lifting weights and stuff like that, just like whatever. So we used to get the newspaper, like the Daily Herald, I think it was, the Provo newspaper. And they had this crazy article about this guy, and I'm sitting there watching him. He's like doing a handstand with his shirt off, and he had gotten in a motorcycle wreck and became a paraplegic. And he started doing yoga. You know, they told him he'd never walk again. He started doing yoga, and all of a sudden he got feeling back in his legs and was able to walk, and he was like full recovery. And I've had a head injury. When I was working construction, I fell 2 stories off a building, landed on my head.
Oh, jeez.
Had some brain bleeding and stuff like that. A series of miracles mitigated that, and I was able to – as my mom said, I had a new, bright, pleasant personality. That was the best part about it. But – so I'd had head injuries. I'd had a spine injury because I'd also unbeknownst to me, I also broke my back when I fell, but I didn't find out about that till later. But anyways, I'm just reading this article and just the farm boy in me, instead of like doing some sort of surgery or something to fix it, I'm like, yeah, I think I can, I'm going to start taking yoga. So I go up to the local rec center in American Fork, and it just so happens that this wonderful lady, Lisa Brown, teaches yoga. She's an amazing teacher. She's also a brain and spinal injury nurse.
Yeah.
So I told her what happened, and she's like, you've come to the right place. We're going to fix you. And I started taking yoga at the chances of having this type of, not only in the medical field, but also the Zen teacher that she is. She's taken workshops all over the country. She was an amazing yoga teacher. To have that combination right up the road from me, and I started taking yoga, and after a year, I felt I could do back bends. I felt like not only recovered, but better than I'd felt ever.
Dang.
I just felt great. And so I just kept with it. And I still have a lot of residual pain, a lot of back pain. Sometimes it flares up pretty bad. Sometimes I do have to go in and get treatment from, you know, a doctor that I like. But for the most part, if I can stay active and doing my yoga, I feel fantastic. And it's just like, and the interesting thing is Lisa, my teacher, just like Blair, she was more like a mentor. She's like, you need to start teaching yoga. And I'm like, I don't want to teach yoga. I'm like some chubby, hairy guy. And she's like, all the more reason you need, because we need to bring more men into yoga.
I agree.
So I started teaching yoga. I got certified and stuff like that. And I teach classes. So now Lisa and I, we actually take turns teaching it. We teach a free class. We teach two free classes every week.
That's awesome.
And we have a group of ladies still, every once in a while, a couple guys will come, but for the most part, it's a bunch of grandmas that can do handstands and push-ups, and they're tough sons of guns. They're like end of days. That's the group of ladies you want to hang out with, because they are tougher than nails, and they're just awesome. Bunch of grandmas that can do more push-ups than their grandsons that play football and stuff like that. Like my boy that plays rugby and football, he'll come to, he doesn't like to come to yoga. He's like, it's too hard. I hate it. All those ladies are way stronger than me.
Like, that's why you keep coming.
Anyways, so that's how I got into yoga and how I got into teaching. I like to teach. I probably like teaching yoga more than I like teaching sculpture, because sculpture is frustrating because people come not with baggage, but art's kind of funny for a lot of people. Like, a lot of people aren't necessarily open to be molded. Like when I was up and coming, I wanted to get as much knowledge as I could. And I'm like, teach me. I want to learn anything I can from you. And I've thought that I've gotten myself to a certain level of, I don't know, respect in the art world, where people would, you know, they're taking my workshop because they want to learn from me. But a lot of times when you're teaching art, a lot of people just want a pat on the back.
Yeah.
And that's not a fun way to teach. It's fun. It's much more fun and enjoyable to, you know, teach, like help people get better. And if you're just there to kind of like,
just hand out gold stars. And
yeah. Hand out gold stars. It's just, it's not very fun.
No.
And that's what I find with work. So a lot of people are like, oh, you teach workshops? I'm like, no. Not anymore. I used to, but I just don't enjoy. Now, someone comes in yoga, like if you physically can't do it, it's like, okay, I can help you. This is what you're going to do. Here's a modification. And people are willing to do it because I think yoga puts you in such a vulnerable spot that you're willing to like accept any help. And not everyone approaches art learning with the same vulnerability, I think. So. But yoga keeps me humble too, because every time I think I'm pretty good at it, the same thing, I'll go take some workshop and I'm like, oh, dang.
Yeah. I thought I knew what I was doing. I thought I knew what I was sculpting.
Then the spiritual aspect of it, like, because even my yoga teacher, even as she's gotten older and slowed down a little bit physically, not that she can't do anything she could do 20 years ago, but she's gotten more into the breathing techniques, the pranayama, and that's where yoga masters really go, where you can go into the deep meditation and that really settling your mind and compartmentalizing all your, you know, kind of the opposite of PTSD, where PTSD is something where you can't compartmentalize thoughts, and because you have some traumatic thing, it makes you unable to compartmentalize your thoughts. And so you have these panic attacks and you have a hard time functioning, where yoga breathing does the opposite effect. It calms to the point where, you know, you get into that Zen state, and it's awesome. It's a fun place to go, but it's, in a lot of ways, it's a lot more challenging than to push yourself to do the physical things, is to do the breathing and thinking and, you know,
it's a lot more surrendering. There's a lot more degrees of difficulty than just being able to hold a breath.
Yeah. It's like I always tell people at the end of class, every, you know, we've done some really hard things. I've gotten lots of grunts and moans, but it's like, now we're going to lay on our back in Shavasana and not do anything. And this is literally the hardest pose, is to completely release. Can you completely release? And it's hard for me too, but yeah, and it's awesome. Yeah. But it's so fun because what it does is it keeps me humble, keeps me motivated. And it's just like, sculpture. It keeps me humble, and anytime I think I'm good, I'll be in the studio. When it's funny, I work really late sometimes, and at 2 a.m. I'm pretty awesome, and I get up at 8 and come back down here, and I'm like, "What were you thinking? That looks stupid."
Like, you wasted 3 hours doing this. Let's fix this.
Oh, one step forward, 3 steps back, and you know, once again, it goes back to what I talked about, the problem solving, just the art of problem solving. And that's, you know, we were at the doctor's today with my son. He had like a broken finger. And, you know, I was thinking about even practicing medicine. Medicine has become so streamlined today that we've like lost the art of medicine. Like, it used to be one of the fine arts. Like David McCullough's book, The American Journey to Paris, I love that because he follows politics, medicine, sculpture, art, painting, and philosophy. And how those used to be like all the liberal arts, like medicine was in there. And I was just like, it made me kind of sad thinking about today, like all this insurance stuff and everything. I'm like, does anyone here practice medicine? Like the art of medicine? And, you know, I talked to many old doctors that just, they bemoan the days of, you know, before everything became streamlined through insurance companies and what you can and can't do. And it's just like, yeah, we've lost our ability to problem solve on our own, like treat patients individually instead of as like, oh, here's what you do for this and that's it. Check out.
So different.
So it's sad because some of our most intelligent human beings, that's what they go into. They go into to medicine and stuff like that because they're like, well, I'm really smart. You can make money.
Yeah. Let's next be thing a doctor. You know, they're just following a to-do list.
Yeah.
Red tape everywhere.
And then they're taking some sculpture workshop and they're like, I really should have done something more artistic and I wish I would have, but I became a, you know, a heart surgeon.
Yeah. You find out, you definitely find out eventually.
Oh, shoot.
But I guess outside of yoga and sculpting, what else occupies your time or what do you like to do around?
I love sports. I don't golf. My brother's a golfer. I golf and just cuss. So it's not very good for me. Because I don't know, I just have this expectation the ball should go where I want it to go, but I don't have the patience to learn something like that.
There you go.
So yeah, I still am involved in football because it's kind of my job, you know. So I get to watch a lot of football, and
nice.
I'm finding I enjoy it less and less through the years. I've really gotten into rugby. As my son started playing rugby, I realized that rugby is I love this sport. It's like such a fun sport to watch. This last year with the World Cup, we were in Fiji for the last 2 weeks of the World Cup. So to be in a, you know, a rugby crazed nation, you know, was a lot more fun than watching it here. And nobody knows what's going on.
It's another country. It's at the time of the day.
So I was in Brazil in 1998 when they were in the World Cup final against France that they lost. And it was just like to see an entire nation so passionate about a sport and, you know, it was cool, but soccer isn't something that I've always loved. I still enjoy watching it, but rugby definitely. In the last couple of years, I've really become like, I've got all the rugby pass, the like random apps and stuff like that. Uh-huh. Carrie's like, what is this for? Game flow? And I'm like, oh, it's the only place that shows Reunion Rugby, World Rugby.
Sorry.
That's what I got to watch. And so that's about it. And then, you know, being a parent, raising kids, that's still the most challenging thing that I do. Art's sculpture's a walk in the park compared to trying to raise kids.
Seriously.
I mean, geez Louise. Me and my wife, we've been married for 25 years. I mean, it has its ups and downs like anything. Like right now, my wife's just struggling terribly with her health and trying to figure out what it is and everything. I mean, it's been, and I mean, it's frustrating for me. I can't imagine how frustrating it is for her, but it, you know, those things stink. I don't know how to solve that. Yeah. That I can't solve with hard work and dedication to my craft. It's one of those things where it's like, all I can do, and it's awesome because this goes back to yoga where it's about a surrender. All I can do is just love the people that are around me and do my best to serve and love them. You know, not that I'm perfect at it or even good, but if I can be mediocre at it,
yeah,
then I'm going to keep working at it. But that's the real challenge of life. That being in the studio is actually a relief. I mean, I'm doing what I love. I'm problem solving all day, so it keeps me engaged. I never feel bored at work. People talk about the monotony of their job. I'm like, oh my gosh, I can't even imagine.
That kind of sounds nice sometimes. Like every day is different.
Well, it's funny because I still do a lot of the things that other artists don't. Like I make my own molds. It's cathartic for me to like mold the piece after I'm finished working on it, to paint silicone rubber over the whole thing and put plaster on top of it and, you know, bugger it up and damage it through the process of making a mold of it. And people are like, why do you make your own molds? And I'm like, they're like, is it to save money? And I'm like, no, I just do it because it's monotonous. It's something that it has a start and an end, and then you're done. And I'm like, it's physical and it's, you know, I like doing that because it's something that's easy in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Especially after going through something that's very, like, not processed, very ambiguous, very abstract.
Well, yeah, and when you're creating artwork, you don't ever finish it. You abandon it. And I used to think, like, oh, that's just the corniest thing that all artists say. But it's true. You literally – that's why I like to work on the mold. I'm like, I'm painting rubber on this. I can't touch the clay anymore. I can't change something. And it's funny. When I'm making my own mold, I'm to the point where I have a sculpture tool in one hand and a paintbrush in the other where I'm painting the rubber on. I'm like, okay, leave it alone, Hammond. Just let it go.
Yeah, you're done.
And just – so it's – like I said, it's cathartic. It's like right now getting my studio organized, building a wood shop. I've been building cabinets for the last couple of days with my helper. And sometimes it's nice to do.
Yeah.
Just do something different.
I was going to say do something with your hands, but you always do something with your hands.
Well, you saw me putting the CBD oil on because I was doing so much with my hands that they're getting a little inflamed, so I had to calm that down a little bit.
Dang. Yeah, I can't imagine. Like, I've had family that have been, like, massage therapists, and, like, they're like, oh, my hands hurt. Like, I can't really do this anymore.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine how – I don't know. I'm just curious.
Yeah, pushing clay all day. I'll tell you one thing. What I can do is if my boys act up, I can grab them by the neck and squeeze a little bit, and they feel like they've been lashed by some sort of machine or something like that. Yeah, like
strong hands.
These hands. I wish I had hands like this when I wrestled in high school. Like,
you would
man,
have been state
it
champ.
It was like, growing up in Southeast Idaho, I hated when you at a wrestling match and within 2 seconds you knew whether that guy milked cows by hand. Like, as soon as he grabs your wrist or something, you're just like, oh crap, I'm dead. This guy is like, I'm like, I milked cows a couple times because my dad felt it was important that we milked a cow by hand. Just to
part of the checklist of Idaho.
Yeah, but oh my gosh, that was the worst. Like, oh my heck, this dude wakes up every morning at 5:30 and milks 2 cows, and I'm going to get thrown around by this guy.
I don't blame it at all.
Shoot.
Well, Ben, I want to end with the two questions I always ask every guest. First, if you could have someone on the podcast and hear about their story, who do you think you'd want to hear from?
Someone from Utah?
From Utah, lives here, someone has a cool story, anything and everything.
You know, there's one of the most interesting people, I'd say Matt Harper. Matt Harper, he grew up in Blackfoot, Idaho. He called me up years ago, and just his wife's an artist, so we've always been kind of run into each other because of art things. And he calls me up, he's like, hey, you want to go to lunch? And I'm like, sure, yeah, I'll go to lunch. And I was like, man, is he trying to network or what? Like, what's going on? And, you know, because we weren't like, we grew up in the same area. We weren't necessarily friends. We were more had like friends who were friends. And we were going out to lunch and I'm like, what's up? And he's just like, oh, I just needed to visit with somebody else from Idaho. And I'm just like, okay, that's awesome. So we've gotten to be friends over the years. He's actually the one that built this addition onto my studio.
Oh, interesting.
And he's one of the most fascinating people. He's really sharp. He has like he was doing a PhD in geology. He still works as a what do they call it when you hire somebody to come and give advice? Why can't I think
consulting?
Of it? Consulting. Yeah, he still does some consulting for some geological things for companies and stuff like that. But super smart guy. Just real interesting story how he got to now he's building custom homes and built an artist studio and he does great craftsmanship and he's just a guy that grew up like I did in Southeast Idaho and now he's living in Utah and he's a successful contractor and like I said, builds really beautiful high-end homes and stuff like that.
That's awesome.
Yeah. In fact, he was excited to do the studio because he's like, finally, I can just build a box.
He's like, I don't have to do anything else.
I don't have to do a kitchen. Yeah. I don't have to pick out marble or anything. It's just like, it's straightforward. Nice. But, you know, yeah. I gave him enough twists and turns that he still had some challenges and things like that.
There you go.
Yeah. Just, I'm always interested in builders. I've just, maybe it's because of the way I grew up, but. He's an interesting fellow and married to a painter, successful painter. So
I love that. And then if anybody wants to find more about you, your art, where's the best place to find that?
I don't Google me, I guess.
That works.
I am terrible at social media, but I post most often when I do post on Instagram at Ben Hammond Fine Art. Okay. I have my website, benhammondfineart.com. And then you can Google things, Ben Hammond Hall of Fame. Sometimes there's videos that pop up on YouTube of guys sitting for me. Usually they'll kind of film that process. But yeah, cool. I don't know.
Otherwise, go to your local foundry, try to find him, and then you go be as
– You could probably knock on my door. If you bring like a whatchamacallit candy bar, I'll let you in.
the rite of passage.
Yeah, that's what I love is a good whatchamacallit.
Noted because I can't think of a single other person I know that loves a whatchamacallit, so more for you.
Oh, man. One of my funny stories just to end is speaking of whatchamacallit is Orlando Pace. He's a – big, huge guy with a beard right there. One of the biggest men I've ever hung out with. So he came out to pose for his sculpture. And, you know, we went to lunch at the Wing Shack. Usually, Wing Shack is one of my favorite places to bring football.
Me and John went there last time.
Oh, I love the Wing Shack. So anyways, we go to the Wing Shack. We get wings. And, you know, we've eaten enough that most people are full. And I tell Orlando, I'm like, I got to run over to they used to have a 7-Eleven next to it. And I'm like, I got to go grab a couple whatchamacallits. You want a candy bar? And he's like, you're going to eat a candy bar after we ate all those wings? I'm like, I need some chocolate to settle my stomach. And yeah. He's just like, he laughed about that. He's just like, yeah, get me a whatchamacallit. I've never had one. And I get him a whatchamacallit. We have whatchamacallits. And he's like, that does taste good after. And I'm like, you're like, darn right.
Told you.
So, and then on the way home, I'm taking him back to the airport. And he's like, is that an In-N-Out? And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, oh man, I'd love to stop and get it in. Let's get an In-N-Out. I'm like, let's do it. Sure, so perfect. We get In-N-Out. So after we ate wings and then that dinner, we went to In-N-Out. Take him to the airport. The next time I see him is like 2017. We're out in Canton. And Jerry Jones is having his big party. I wasn't invited, but Orlando was. Orlando sees me in the hotel. He's like, hey, Ben, come here. And he's like, I'm like, what's up, Orlando? And he's like, his wife's with him. He's like, this is Ben. This guy can eat as much as I can. And he taught me about whatchamacallits and eating chocolate after you have a heavy – he's like, it's the best thing to settle your stomach, isn't it? I'm like, yeah. And anyways, so we were laughing about that. And he's like, you going to Jerry's party? And I'm like, no, I didn't get invited. And he's like, come with me. So because I ate a whatchamacallit after wings, it got me into this private party at Jerry Jones. And I've never been to anything like that since or before. But holy cow, that dude knows how to throw a party. It was pretty awesome. Like private like concert, Justin Timberlake. Like Dang. It was crazy. I'm like, and I've never listened to Justin Timberlake before or after, but that was sweet.
But that was pretty was cool. So there you go. Never underestimate the power of a whatchamacallit.
Oh yeah. Or eating like a, you know, like I eat too much probably, but anyways, it impressed Orlando Pace. That's there all I got to say.
It sounds like it worked for me. Well, thanks again, Ben, for having me, especially in your studio. It's always such a fun place because sculpting studios are by far the best.
Yeah, we all know that.
Awesome. Well, thanks, man. All right. It's so funny because I had heard I can't remember who told me the story about the back and yoga. Someone did in past. It might have been Howard, actually. I was like, wait, what? And he's like, oh, yeah, you're going to have to ask him.
Howard used to come to some of my yoga classes. He's just like, oh, I can't do any of it. And I'm just like,
Oh, that's why I'm here.
Do I unplug this?
I'll take care of it.
Okay. I know. One thing I've had.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of Smalt Lake City Podcast. Don't forget to like, follow, review, subscribe, and share this episode with your friends. And we'll catch you next week. We'll see you there.